This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, with more cultural correctives from our archives. We recorded this piece in what was the latter part of the last election cycle. As Barack Obama continued on his march toward victory, pundits grew increasingly skeptical. Could he pull it off, they asked, or would he be thwarted by the so-called Bradley effect?
The term refers to the 1982 California gubernatorial race between Republican Attorney General George Duke Majan, who's white, and Democrat and five-term Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, who's black. Even though the polls projected a Bradley win, he lost, supposedly due to hidden racism. In October 2008, political watchers obsessed over the Bradley effect, or whether there could be a reverse Bradley effect, where whites lied about supporting Obama, or even a Bradley effect, whereby voters might be influenced by all the blather over the Bradley effect. Blair Levin worked for Bradley in the 1982 campaign, and he says we're reading the wrong draft of history.
I'm not a pollster, I'm not a statistician, but I was a witness to history, and to hear the history kind of inaccurately reflected caused me sometimes to laugh and sometimes to get a little upset.
I was the chief pollster in that election and part of the strategy team.
Lance Torrance was working for Bradley's opponent, Duke Majan, but like Blair, he's had enough of all the references to the effect.
In fact, I took it personally because so many people were quoting what happened in 82 that probably weren't even alive then, number one, and number two, had their facts messed up. And what really determined that it was a close election was the tracking. That was where we did interviews every single night. And from that, we knew we were doing better and better. We started out a double-digit behind in early October, and by mid-October, it climbed within 7 points or so. By the end of the election, we knew it was within 1% either way. The Republicans did an absentee vote program stronger than the Democrats. The Democrats probably took that election a little bit for granted.
That day, we all had the emotion we thought we were going to win, but we also knew there was a significant risk we wouldn't. It was going to be a close election.
Bradley campaign staffer Blair Levin.
The night of the election, when the exit polls had declared Bradley the victor, there were 3,000 people celebrating downstairs at the hotel where we were having the party. And I was upstairs looking at the early polling results and realizing that first there were a huge number of absentee ballots that were not in our calculations and that they must have come from the Republican side. And then second, that there were the turnout in Central Valley was significantly greater than we had anticipated. And that had to do with the fact that there was this gun control initiative, which we knew would be a problem, but we had not anticipated the extent to which people in the Central Valley would show up, and they were largely Republican voters as well.
That blew a hole in the Democrats' arithmetic.
And they lost by a small margin, but they still lost.
I think it was less than 100,000 votes.
But Levin says hidden racism did not cause Bradley's defeat.
Well, to be clear, race definitely played a role in the election in a way that I suspect we'll never know. But what I feel very confident of is that those who say that there's this Bradley effect in which people lie to pollsters, that was not the cause. Bradley actually won Election Day. That is to say, if you take out the absentee ballots, he would have won.
Lance Torrance.
Now, the suggestion that race was a factor, and this is very important, really came from the preeminent public pollster in the state, Mervyn Field, who ran the California poll. And he proclaimed rather loudly right before the election that Bradley would win handily, in fact, by 7 or 8 points. The press accepted this as probably going to make history. It was Merv Field, after the election was over, after the embarrassing results, who said, race must have been a factor. That's the only reason I can think of why our data was so off. But he never once really proved his case. And so from his comments after the election, the Bradley effect was born.
And Torrance, still a Republican strategist, says it persists because it's politically marketable.
This is purely a suggestion on my part of how it would be used in a marketing sense. You would tell particularly the black community that there is a lot of hidden racism that's going to somehow turn the election around and that you need to make sure you vote. Why else would a theory as porous, that is, not solid, be carried forward so long in American politics unless people wanted to keep race front and center? And it's quite historical to have a black man running for president of the United States, and a lot of people want that to happen. And indeed, Obama's favored to win this election. So it becomes one of these shadowy mysteries that maybe he might be denied this election at the last moment by invoking this Bradley effect. And I think that this is a disservice to the American voting public.
The thing that struck me personally most,
Blair Levin,
Tom Bradley was really a wonderful person and really practiced the politics of inclusion. He presided for 20 years over an incredibly multicultural city. He helped bring the city together in many, many ways. And the notion that Tom Bradley is now remembered to a generation as part of this incident in which race played a very significant role, or at least that's the urban legend, saddened me tremendously. I mean, Tom Bradley ought to be remembered for something else, how he governed.
The Bradley effect had more or less dropped out of the political lexicon when it returned with a vengeance after the New Hampshire primary, famously lost by Obama after he was leading in the polls. In fact, in a Nexus search, we found only 87 mentions of the Bradley effect in the 5 years prior to that primary. In the 9 months that followed, it was mentioned more than 1,000 times. But polling wunderkind Nate Silver, who blogs at 538.com, told us there was no Bradley effect in New Hampshire. He says Obama's numbers went up after a decisive victory in the Iowa caucus, but a lot happened in the days leading to New Hampshire that the polls didn't have time to reflect.
In that interval between, I think it was a Thursday when Obama won the Iowa caucus and the Tuesday when New Hampshire voted, you had a debate. Hillary had a very dramatic kind of teary moment at a press conference. And you also had a Republican race. And in New Hampshire, they have an open primary. Literally, you kind of go in and decide, do I want a red ballot or a blue ballot, you know, Democrat or Republican. About half of the voters are independents. So I think a lot of independents who like both Obama and McCain might have looked at those polls and said, Obama's 8 points, 9 points ahead. McCain's in a very tight race with Mitt Romney. I'm going to have more leverage if I vote for McCain because I want to see those two candidates nominated.
So you refer to a study by a professor at Harvard as the definitive study on the Bradley effect. What did it find?
Yeah, it was a professor, I think, named Daniel Hopkins, who's a postdoc at Harvard. And he went back and looked at the polling in, you know, all sorts of races, gubernatorial races, Senate races, as well as this year's primaries, going back to 1980. When he found there did used to be a Bradley effect, which was pretty noticeable, maybe a 5 or 6 point margin where a black candidate would underperform his polls. In Chicago, Harold Washington won his mayoral race but was supposed to win by a larger margin. You know, David Dinkins in New York, you know, Wilder in Virginia, it's sometimes called the Wilder effect as well. So there were enough cases in that window from about 1982 to 1991. But sometime in the 90s, you stop seeing this where the polls are accurate. You know, for example, for Harold Ford in the Senate race in Tennessee, he lost, but he didn't lose by any more than was expected. So why it disappeared is the interesting question to me. The Harvard study speculates maybe it was the fact that issues like crime and welfare and affirmative action, which were, you know, really hot-button issues during the 80s, are not really the kind of at the forefront of the discussion today. I also think the fact that the electorate has changed, where racism is inversely correlated with education levels. Right now, I think something like 75 to 80% of the electorate has been to at least some college where you'll integrate with students of different backgrounds, whereas in 1988, 84, that number was more like 60%. It's generational as well. I mean, but it's partly just these things turning over slowly at a time, but there's no evidence that the Bradley effects existed for the past 10 years or so. We're kind of relying on quarter-century-old examples to kind of prop this idea up.
So it's a combination of essentially two things. Our society has changed, and polling methods have also changed, right?
I think so. I mean, you know, I also think people's attitude toward polls may have changed. If a pollster calls, you see them as a stranger, whereas before, you might see them almost as a neighbor or a friend, and then you might gravitate toward socially desirable behavior. That's where the whole notion comes from, the idea that people want to conceal their racism, I suppose. But if you see the pollster as just an anonymous nobody on the end of the phone, and some of these polls now actually use automated calling scripts, so-called robocalls, you'll press a touch tone literally. So there's no human interaction at all. So that might be another factor, is that people feel more free to express themselves.
Nate, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nate Silver is founder of the blog 538.com.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.